Welcome to Meet the Artist. Christian, you're a Norwegian freelance photojournalist, or would you say documentary photographer to be more correct?
Photographer, yeah.
Photographer.
I think any term these days would work.
But they have slightly different implications, and I guess we should talk about that too.
We could talk about that too. You know, back in the day, I remember when I did my undergrad studies in London, there was a list of different kind of formal titles for photographers. The list had 130 titles, which is crazy. That included dental photographers, to photojournalists, to documentary photographers, to all kinds of different things. And today, most photographers, they would say photojournalist or documentary photographer or photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And in my book, they're all the same.
Okay.
I teach courses with the different terminologies, but that's mostly to divide up the topics into different kinds of way of working.
So, right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're a photographer based today in Sarajevo, Bosnia, and you work with a number of organizations. There's a lot of organizations. Some of them are the Aga Khan Foundation, it's Enfants du Monde, the WTO, the Holocaust Memorial Day Trust, and et cetera. There's many others that I probably haven't included here. And also publications like the International Herald Tribune, the Daily Telegraph, Le Temps, 24 Heures, Banker Magazine, Neue Zürcher Zeitung, excuse my bad German, and more.
I have worked with them in the past, yeah. I don't regularly work with them, but I do partner with an agency, Keystone, here in Switzerland.
In Zurich.
And they, so normally if I have pictures in any of those magazines, it's through them or through companies or organizations I worked with that have used my pictures in those publications, yeah.
And your current project still deals with the aftermath of genocide and war, specifically life today in places like Srebrenica and Bosnia and Rwanda, and other places as well. Would you say that sort of sums you up as far as the topic of your concern, or would you want to say something else about, you know, because it's always very tricky to label people, and I don't want to do that in a way that you did just fine. Okay, good. Because it is important how people define you, right? It's part of your brand, so it's. So my first question is going back in time a little bit and trying to find out how you first became aware that you wanted to become a photographer or a photojournalist or a documentary photographer. How did it come about?
So I'm from a family that makes beer.
Oh.
So there's a family company, it's a brewery, and. My grandfather in my family was the first one who kind of had this place. And then it was my parents, my uncles and aunts. They were all working at the brewery. My father, and we had some shops. So my father worked at a shop at the brewery. So when I grew up, I assumed I was going to work at the brewery. Then they sold this business. And I thought, what am I going to do now? So I was quite interested in art, I suppose, or imagery. And started to get a little bit into photography and not knowing what I was going to do, because in a way what I assumed I was going to do was no longer available. I decided to just go with what I thought was interesting, and that's, so I knew relatively early on that I was going to do photography.
When did you first realize? When you were in high
school? During my high school days in Norway, I worked a little bit for the local newspaper, because they had it's a daily newspaper. They had used to have a sort of, in section two, there was a youth section. So I used to photograph about youth culture in my region. And then we had to do military service in Norway. So even prior to that, I actually went to the UK before my military service in the summer. I found a school that I thought looked interesting. And I told them I wanted to become a student there to do photography. So I had my university place before going to the military, so when I finished, I just had to finish that, and then I went on to do that.
Okay. And is there a particular photograph that you remember vividly? This is kind of a classic question, right? Or a photographer you admired in particular that sort of reinforced your sense of wanting to become a photographer? Something really powerful that stayed with you over the years, or a person?
No, not one photograph, but there were a few photographers that I remember well. And there are some of the classics now, like James Nachtwey was someone that when I grew up, you know, he was winning the World Press Award and was sort of the top one that everybody would mm-hmm. admire his work, and everybody should, and everybody still do. He's still working. And some of those pictures coming out from what was going on during those days, you know, in the 90s, if you will,
mm-hmm.
early 90s. And also, there were a couple of pictures that I later on have read about and understood better that I remember from back then
mm-hmm.
that comes to mind. And that's from one book that I refer to a few times to students too, is The Bang Bang Club
mm-hmm.
by the guys photographing the apartheid. And one of those guys from the Bang Bang Club, Gerald Silva, has become a little bit of a friend of mine. And he showed and spoke about, you know, the pictures that came out of those four guys, really. I mean, there was another club called Bang Bang Club. That was the author or the filmmaker who wanted to use that title.
Oh, I see. I didn't know that.
But anyway, those guys were working. So when, what's his name? Carter took his famous picture of the vulture and the child.
Yeah.
That eventually,
for which he got the Pulitzer Prize.
He won the Pulitzer Prize, and he later on committed suicide because of this. I mean, that was not just because of this. It was also because of his drug habits that probably made him mm-hmm. paranoid, but a combination of that.
Right.
Those pictures I remember, and they inspired me. I never had a big desire to become a conflict photographer, and mm-hmm. I never became one, and I have no intentions of that. Mm-hmm. But the photography that was going on, I thought, was really great work, and realized that you need the approach to their work and how they got to that final image, I think, is important. And I was curious about how they managed to do that.
But what they represented in their pictures was, in the case of the apartheid, because if I remember correctly, they documented the final weeks of the apartheid in South Africa.
They documented for a long time.
Okay.
Not just the final weeks.
Okay.
So this was... Actually, those four guys were quite different people
mm-hmm.
in characters, in a way. And they were curious about photography for different reasons, if you will. But the result was similar, and they were quite extreme.
Mm.
And if you talk to people like Joel Silva today, you realize this man is just completely crazy, but in a positive sense of the word.
Mm.
And he still is. I mean, he lost both his legs stepping on a landmine.
Mm.
In Afghanistan later on. But he's also a very, very good photographer. But at the same time, he will say immediately that, you know, I don't think I'm the best photographer in the world, but I know that if anything happens, it's going to be me being right there when it happens. So that's a skill to be there, you know, because being a photographer, clicking the shutter is not necessarily the hardest thing. The hardest thing is to figure out where to be when, or how to get access to where you need to be in order to tell a story.
But when you say you weren't interested in photographing conflict, isn't that what the Bang Bang Club were
That's
doing?
That's what they did. Right. Yeah, they did that.
So what part of their work inspired you?
How they managed, you know, the
how
image.
How did you forge your own path, you know? Because they were in the heat of the action, right? Mm. And that's something you already knew you didn't want to do, or?
No. In a way, that bit of it is a little bit less important for me. It's more, how do they get those pictures happening?
Right.
The Carter picture with the vulture is not in the heat of the action. That's from a feeding station, actually. Right. It's already in a camp. So this child is already in the best place it can be at that time.
Well, not in the camp.
It was in the camp itself?
Yeah. I thought it was a little bit ways away from it.
No, it's in the camp. Okay. So it had already been taken to a feeding station,
and
it was already getting treatment.
Okay. That's an important detail that I don't know how widely known that is.
That's exactly the conflict, in a way, for that he felt as well, because a lot of people didn't read the full text because it was written, but it was not always used.
Because what people ask him is, well, what's recorded is, why didn't you help her instead of taking a picture, right?
And exactly.
And what people say, or at least that's what I've heard, is, I don't know what happened to her.
Yeah, he doesn't know what happened later, but he knew that it was in a feeding station already.
Okay.
So
That's a really important detail, I think, because people are very cruel to photojournalists, actually, right? Yeah. Judgmental, very. I mean, ethics is all over the place. And so, you know, my next questions are going to deal a little bit with ethical questions, and I hope that's okay.
Sure.
But well, my first broader question is, when you started working on the, when did you start working on the topic of life after war specifically?
This was around 2010 when I first went to Srebrenica in Bosnia.
Mm-hmm.
I had worked in various locations and I knew the kinds of topics that I would probably be interested in, not specifically genocide as such, but I mean, but this was maybe, I suppose this was the first time I was, yeah, I was introduced to Srebrenica and very specific things that was going on there. I met very specific people that had survived this ordeal.
Mm-hmm.
And it, in a way, it gave me access to something that I felt, that's funny, you know, people come here, but why don't we hear more about exactly this?
Mm-hmm.
And I started to do more research because I hadn't had time to do much preparation before going there first time,
mm-hmm.
because I was only asked a few days before going.
Mm-hmm.
And then coming back, I realized I had a lot of questions that came to me leaving Bosnia, wondering, I need to have answers to some of these questions at least. Mm-hmm. So I decided to go back again relatively soon afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I went over the next 7 years or so. I probably visited a couple of times a year almost,
mm-hmm.
in average, and started to create those relationships with people and started to have more defined projects about specific people and how they dealt with their life in the aftermath of what they had experienced.
Mm-hmm. So would you agree with the statement that it takes a lot of personal investment in order to do a project right? Or is sometimes this personal investment not necessary to do, to create it, to have a good result? What do you think?
I think it very much depends on the project.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are projects that can happen much, much quicker. And it also depends on who you work with or how you're working. I work mostly on my own. And when you work mostly on your own, it means you do everything on your own. And that, of mm-hmm. course, takes longer than if you're collaborating with an organization. Or if I work with an NGO, there could be 2-3 other people working specifically on what you're doing. So you only do part of it somehow. And you can do a lot more much quicker. But there are pros and cons with both. If you have time, I think that time typically helps a project if you have the patience to wait.
Mm.
Because by investing all of that time and effort on your own with people, it shows commitment to what you're working on too.
Mm-hmm.
And the people you're working with will notice that. So if a person realizes that this guy is really interested, then they would want you to come around, you know? And as mentioned in my talk earlier on, it's about relationship building. And I think that you showing that, that's not going to hurt that relationship building either.
Do you think of your photo work as something that's divided into freelance work versus commissioned work? Is that how you sort of create compartments for it in your mind, or is that too simplistic?
I think we spent a bit of time earlier too talking about how media is changing. And I think also it's very important to understand who's your target audience.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, your target audience would be picture editors or news editors or feature editors,
right.
Who would be interested in these topics. And to some extent, you could argue it still is. But it may not be where you're going to make your impact on a certain story.
Mm.
And that's important to realize, because I was talking to a photo editor in which magazine was it? I think it was Le Temps here in Switzerland.
Mm.
Or Meta, I don't remember, one of them. And they were, she was really interested in these projects and how they worked and everything. But at the same time, she was saying, the reality is this, that our readers sometimes will be more interested in understanding or to hear about what happened to my neighbor's dog that disappeared yesterday than what happened in Bosnia or Rwanda or something. So who's reading and who's reading what where is also important. Today, I think these kinds of stories are appearing in many places, not just newspapers and magazines. In fact, they're appearing less and less in newspapers and magazines. They're appearing more and more in festivals and exhibitions, and in that sense, mixing in with the art world more and more too.
Right.
That's where you will see these news stories as much as anywhere else. And of mm-hmm. course, on the internet, in various platforms, you have places where stories are shared. And that's not always a bad thing, because it's often easier to have longer stories or more imagery or, you know, different video mixed with video photography, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do a project, you research, you prepare, you present, who is it going to be for? Because a story edited for a festival is not going to be the same story as what's going to go in a newspaper or magazine, where you typically have 10 or 12 pictures.
But is it always possible to know and prepare?
No, it's not always possible to know before you prepare. I think it almost never is, actually. So the way I would normally typically work is I would make my own storyboard, just as if I was making a video.
Mm-hmm.
This is not because I'm going to follow my storyboard, but this is part of my research work.
Okay.
So I create a storyboard. I try to anticipate who, what, where, all those basic things,
mm-hmm.
because that allows me to do the research onto all those topics.
Mm-hmm.
I know very well that when I'm on location, I'm most likely not going to follow that storyboard, but it would allow me to already go through my first impression prior to going anywhere.
Mm-hmm. You have context or a frame of some kind.
You have your contacts. You can talk about this topic to the people you're meeting right away, or at mm-hmm. least to some extent talk about it and discuss it.
Yeah.
And then you just do as much as you can, as good as you can, while on location.
Mm-hmm.
And then in your edit, you probably will end up in more than one story. You know, you'll have multiple smaller stories. And then you put it together. And of course, you then do the edit later on. And maybe you can get an edit for all kinds of different formats or target audiences to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
But it depends on if you have any kind of mandate prior to going anywhere. Then, of course, you keep that in mind as well. And you try to kind of cater for that also. But the reality is that a lot of people working in this way, they don't have that prior to going. They have hints. They have knowledge that this is probably going to work here or there, and you work based on that. And they probably have contacts too with NGOs or other organizations who can use this in their work. But today, most people working in this field, they don't have direct mandates. There are some, of course.
Mm. It's interesting to hear you say that you work in terms of a storyline, because mm. I'd always imagine that you sort of hunt for images
mm.
when you go somewhere. So, you know, not necessarily an entire story, just moments mm. or something impactful that speaks to you for whatever reason. But you really think of a narrative, or is that
maybe,
me misunderstanding maybe, what you meant?
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, one doesn't exclude the other, though, to some extent. And I think that maybe storyboard is not the best word, because I don't make a storyboard. It's an open-ended story, if you
right.
will.
Yeah.
It's not, because you don't have a conclusion. I mean, you don't know where the story is going to go or take
yeah.
you. That depends on all kinds of different things. But mm. you do know you can prepare yourself. You can do your research. So they can give you a strong indication in what direction you expect to go with this.
Mm-hmm.
Within that, of course, you're bound to break away from that storyboard, you're bound to follow up on the contacts and the findings or what you found prior to going somewhere. And then while you're there, you're looking for a composition. I think a photographer always look for a composition of things.
Mm-hmm.
A photographer normally would know when the light gets up, you know, when the sunrise is, sunset is, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They should know where are the main landmarks, or, you know, where are the interesting bits in this region or whatever,
mm-hmm.
or wherever you're working. And then you're looking for pictures too, for sure, definitely. But in the end of the day, a documentary photographer would be a storyteller. That's a bit the fancy word these days.
Mm-hmm.
People call themselves storytellers. And that's also, it's not just for fancy reasons. It's also because most people are using more than one medium very often. Therefore, it kind of makes sense in that context.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, you look for composition, but you got to follow your research too.
I think we'll cut this part. It's fine, because we can edit it later.
Someday.
Sometimes the room gets really, really
dry.
And then just have to open the window.
Yep.
Take a little breather.
No problem.
Are you okay with time?
I think so. I don't have time.
Mm.
Yeah, it's okay.
Recording, so. Oh, it's so nice.
Good.
I'm getting over a cold, so it's like
understand. Yeah. Doesn't take much before it helps, I mean.
Yeah, better. It comes really clearly across in your work that you want to engage in people's stories.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no, it's not, photography is fact or as statistic, because you hear a lot of statistics about genocide, and it's clear that you want to go beyond just the facts, the statistics, and you want to engage in it with individuals. So the human aspect is central to your work. I was wondering if you could describe, you know, a bit of a cheeky question, I guess, is when do you stop working as a photojournalist and become a friend? Because to build trust, you need this sort of, right? So where does one stop and one begin? And how do you go back and forth between those two things to build trust? Which is a question we'd already kind of talked about in the workshop, but just...
It's true. I'm glad you asked, because I think it's an important question, and it's something that could be explored a lot more, I think. We spoke about relationship building, and I think that if you talk about storytelling, or if you talk about documenting somebody else's life, or trying to understand, or an aspect of somebody else's life, rather, what's brilliant today with social media is that you can stay in touch with anyone much more than you could only a little while ago. So people who know me and look at my Facebook profile or page or whatever, they will realize that a lot of people that I refer to in my pictures are my friends on Facebook too. Because you meet people wherever you meet, almost wherever you meet them, people are on Facebook or any other sort of social network. So I stay in touch with that way. And that also makes it much easier, of course, to continue follow up on certain stories. An example is a girl, I didn't show any pictures of her today, but Advia, that I met through a friend, Mohammed, that I met on when I walked his peace walk in Srebrenica. So Mohammed, he asked me, you know, Christian, are you, you know, you're interested in these people? Look, I have my father works at a radio station. And a friend or a colleague at a radio station, she lost her father in the genocide. Maybe you'll be interested in meeting her. So I met with Advia in Vogoš outside of Sarajevo. And she said in a few, you know, this was maybe, I don't know, April or something like that. In July for the commemoration, she was going to bury her father. And I said, oh, so maybe I meet you there. Yeah, yeah, sure. If you see me, just come around. That's fine. And I found her and I photographed her.
Is this the one with her hands around her neck that you photographed? Yeah. That's a beautiful picture.
And it was a very complicated picture, actually. It's not a complicated picture, but it was in order to achieve it. Because I tell you, there's a time and a place for everything. And sometimes there's a time and a place for being a photographer, too. And there you're wondering, is it correct to photograph somebody burying her father?
Right.
I'm not sure it is, you know. I would have normally difficulties doing that.
Yeah.
And in any case, I thought, oh, thank goodness I was thinking, because I saw her and her mother, her uncle and aunt and everything. They were standing around this burial, this casket, you know, being about to be buried. About to be buried. And I thought, oh, thank goodness they're standing there, because I can't photograph them. Because they were standing with the sun in their face, on their back. So I wouldn't be able to get a useful picture. And I thought, if I'm not getting a useful picture, I'm certainly not going to photograph. And since they're standing like that, then there's no point anyway. And it took me away from having to make that decision, you know, almost sort of chicken out from it. And then later on, I was hanging around a bit and made, you know, she saw I was there, and she was actually very happy that I was there, very pleased that I could come. You know, we had recently met and everything. And she walked up to me suddenly and she said, you know, Christian, don't worry, you can photograph, it's okay. I don't know, okay. And then I realized, but they're all standing in the wrong way. I can't get a good picture from this. How am I going to do that? And now she even asked me, then I felt I should photograph her.
Right.
And in the end, I realized it wasn't going to happen. And then she turns around and she said, thank you very much for coming. And at that moment, when she turns around, she stood in the right position. And that 1 second, I took a picture, and then that's the picture I've been used a few times.
One picture and you got it. Wow.
And then later on, of course, since we were on Facebook, she contacted me and said, you know, Kristen, I'm getting married. And I said, congratulations. And then afterwards, she, you know, I got a son. So I went to her to photograph her again, you know, that's with her baby. So in a way, it becomes sort of a, you stay in touch and you keep moving on with what's going on. And I think it's nice to see that, because originally, before moving to Sarajevo, and you know, thinking how can this be done in a meaningful way for others to learn from also, you know, creating that impact with the public and, you know, say, look, this is going on and this is how people are dealing with it. This is how, what's going on today. Maybe 8,000 something people got killed in a week in Srebrenica, but at the same time, these are the people behind those numbers. That's what this is about. And that's how I started to work on that. And they're just leading normal lives. In that sense, it's good to sort of stay in touch longer term. That was the idea.
So this is quite an emotional investment. I mean, keeping in touch with people. And it's, I mean, this is exactly what we were talking about before, becoming almost a friend. So where
it becomes a friend. And I, and frankly, I consider many of these people have become my friends.
Does it make it easier to photograph them or harder, though?
Maybe both, because at the same time, you know, getting to know people better, people often ask me, you know, isn't it difficult to photograph people that go through all these awful things? Yeah, there's an aspect of that too. But when you become friends with people, you meet people in different contexts, and it's not always awful. You know, we go out for dinner together sometimes. We have a drink together or a coffee together or something. You see that people are continuing to live normal lives too, you know.
Yeah.
Yes, they have that heaviness to them also, but life has to continue. And that's the bit which is interesting, you know. So in a way, no, it doesn't become more difficult. It becomes, if anything, I would say easier. And it's also good to see that people are having good times in their life too. So
Yeah, to show that they're resilient to their circumstances. So the photojournalist, it seems like you're saying, has a sense of responsibility vis-a-vis his subject. The way you described, you felt it was necessary to have a very delicate, to have a delicacy in your approach when dealing with the context of the burial. Like you couldn't just, you didn't feel right about just going and taking pictures without even thinking about it, you know. So would you say that the photojournalist has a responsibility vis-a-vis his viewer as well?
But I think that anyone photographing or videoing or photographing certain situations, photographing other people, I think that there are... this is also why I always like James Nachtwey's approach, because he's a man that shows a lot of respect towards the people he's photographing. And he described it quite well once when he was saying, first of all, you have to remember one thing, that if you're photographing people in war, I mean, he's a war photographer, the rules are not the same as if you're photographing people in not war. That was not him being disrespectful. It was just saying that a photographer in a war situation, people in a war situation, they understand by default pretty much that a photographer is there to try to document them in order to help them by spreading the news what's going on. So they would typically respect photographers coming closer in certain situations. You know, you typically see photographs of people crying with a dead baby or something, you know, like an awful scene.
Like the one that won the World Press
by Paul Hansen.
Recently.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, these things are going on. And that may be okay in that situation, but when there's no more war going on, for example, me photographing Advia burying her father, the same rules no longer apply. That's why I felt difficulties photographing somebody doing this, because I think it's not correct. It should be a private moment in a way. Had it been a conflict, it would be different, because it would be important to get that image or that message out. But so towards the viewer, I think there are ethical standards that you need to follow in terms of what you want to show to others as well. I mentioned earlier on that, you know, I wouldn't pay somebody to appear in something that should mean to be, let's say, an editorial or newsworthy type story. Because I think that would be wrong.
To stage a scene,
Yeah, you can't do that and say, well, yeah, I paid that guy to be in front of my camera.
But you have people who willingly want to stage a scene.
Yeah, and sometimes you have people who have done it too.
Have you come across this? Not you, but what if you come across a scene and, you know, you say that, well, this is a, quoting what you said about the context of war, but let's say you're not in that context, but you're in a dramatic kind of, you know, photographing something quite dramatic or difficult, and people want to stage something for you so that you export that. Does that ever happen? Or is this just awful, cynical? I've never been in that
kind of situation. Okay. No. But I think that I think I spoke to another photographer who works in conflict, and the discussion was on, you know, when are you a photographer, when are you somebody trying to help a situation? And that's, you're always got to be someone who helps rather than photography. You know, photography is always second if it's too, something really crazy goes on. Right. I've never been in this kind of situation, so I can really comment on it. But I know this guy has many times, and he would always put his camera down if it was necessary, if he felt that that would be the better thing to do. But also, you have to remember that photographers often work where there already are people helping. And it's not always that you're going to be able to help. You may cause more trouble than you're helping too. You know, you got to make sure you're out of the way when these people who are helping are coming, for example. That's what quoting this guy, but
right. I have so many questions. We're gonna edit this out a little bit. I have so many questions for you. Just like yesterday, they all came out like one after the other. another question I had came during the workshop which you gave earlier, which I thought was fantastic. It was a very nice, intimate conversation, wasn't it?
Yes, thank you. I agree.
And the WHA is doing tremendous, you know, contributing so much to hosting these events, these Meet the Artist events, and it's great to have them involved. And I forgot the
question. That's all right.
Yeah. I'll just take a little breather again.
But there is an interesting thing, though, because, I mean, this conversation came up, too, with the Steve McCurry pictures that was being manipulated and so on. And my thoughts brings back to his pictures and the debate that followed when they realized his picture had been manipulated or changed or whatever. So that's one thing, which is a no-go anywhere when you work in trying to do documentary photography, of course. So he had done that, or his assistant, whoever did it, but it was done on some of his pictures. But another thing is, the story that came to that had a little bit less coverage was the fact that he also staged some pictures. And there are a couple of pictures of his that are sort of quite famous from India, from a train station. You have this woman walking on board in a train, and you have this guy working for her, carrying her luggage. And the guy carrying the luggage came forward and said, I remember making that picture. Yeah, it looks very heavy and everything. Well, those suitcases are empty in reality.
Oh.
You know, so clearly very, very staged.
Yeah.
And that's problematic on the one hand. It's problematic depending on how those pictures are being defined. You know, is this meant as documentary? Is it meant as aesthetic art pictures or whatever?
Yeah.
Steve McCurry, though, came with an answer that was maybe problematic in the sense that he just said it's problematic maybe for many to realize that I shifted from being a documentary photographer to being an art photographer or whatever. So he took himself away from that.
To give himself a bit more artistic license.
Yeah. But then, you know, did his green-eyed girl from Afghanistan, is she actually green-eyed? I don't know. I mean, who knows? Because if that's wrong, then what else is wrong?
But when does it start to matter? To manipulate.
Does it matter?
The image, you know, to manipulate the image.
I think it depends on the context of its usage. So if you're presenting something, saying that this is basically how it is, this is real, then it's important to be authentic about it. Like, just like when you write something, you cannot write down lies. You have to write down what you see, kind of thing. On the other hand, is it... Does it really make a difference? Or is it, I don't know. In the sense that the story you're trying to tell, whether you do it this way or that way, the story is still the same, kind of thing. But I think in the context of Steve McCurry, I think it's absolutely vital that it's not been manipulated, that it's not changed or anything, because the authenticity of the entire story, including the text, suddenly becomes one big question mark. Because if you allow yourself to change that, where else did you allow yourself to change something?
Right.
And you got to remember, this guy is a photographer. He's part of the Magnum agency.
Mm-hmm.
And ironically, of course, Magnum was founded on the principle so that our pictures cannot be edited or used in the wrong context.
And have they not changed their ground rules at all?
Oh, yeah.
Because of digital?
They seem to be changing a lot, and it's becoming more of a documentary, artistic, commercial agency than anything else, you know. Also doing documentary work, but they do all kinds of other things too.
How do you think professional photographers look at pictures versus viewers, like the common viewer?
Yeah. That's a good question. I think there are a lot of different common viewers, though.
Mm.
And I think there are many ways of reading an image. And I think that that's something that, working in education, I think that should be maybe more present also in education today. Because, I mean, what are images, and how are images being used, and how are images being used in a general news story in terms of storytelling?
Mm-hmm.
It goes hand in hand with media literacy and all kinds of different things too. Fundamentally, though, a good image or a bad image can stand out. But the thing is, given the context, it depends also. Because I think there are certain key rules in order to getting a good image, if you can generalize super badly. You know, if the light is in the right place or colors are working well, and etc. There are good ways to creating a good image.
Mm.
But at the same time, if you're creating a picture essay or a story like that, that contains several pictures, then it, classically speaking, maybe a good image doesn't have to be there. You know, maybe it's not typically a good image. I think oftentimes that people who are not into imagery or photography or whatever, sometimes it's like literature. Certain books will not appeal to the masses. Certain books will appeal to people who are used to reading a lot of books, you know.
Mm.
And I think it's the same with photography too. There are a lot of great photographers that I honestly cannot say that I appreciate their individual pictures all the time, but I do appreciate to what extent they've gone into a certain situation in order to get those images. And I know that that will be very difficult. So to have anything from there is pretty good,
mm.
you know. It's kind of vague. I would almost have to use the images to show you what I mean. But
yeah, it's difficult without the visuals.
Yeah.
I was just wondering about the viewers who come to the shows that you do and who view work. You know, the things that they noticed. Is there anything that surprises you that they notice that you never would have thought of, or that you're less sensitive to because you're professional?
You mean in terms of the aesthetics of pictures, or
anything, the form, the content?
A few times, not oftentimes though. Oftentimes people tend to respond perhaps a little bit in the direction I would expect sometimes.
Mm.
But there was one presentation I did once, I remember. A guy just basically said, you know, I woke up feeling good today, and I come to your presentation, I feel bad. Thank you very much. And he was sort of ironic.
Okay.
And I thought that was surprising, because I was surprised to meet someone who just did not care, because it was outside of his region. You know, he just wasn't interested. It was beyond where this guy was living. So, you know, why would he bother about something that was outside?
Just maybe defensive or like
maybe
scared.
I mean, in a way, I mean, this kid, well, he was a student. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily blame him forever, you know, but I was surprised to meet someone who just wasn't that interested in that.
Mm.
So, but anyway, that didn't really bother me. It was just, you meet all kinds of people sometimes. So.
Yeah. Is it ever difficult to get people to agree that you take a photo of them?
Sometimes it can be difficult, but I don't really bother with people who are not interested in being photographed. If they don't want to be photographed, they don't want to be photographed, and I don't photograph them.
Hmm.
Simple as that. There's no point trying to And to some extent, I can understand too. I'm not necessarily someone who would love to be photographed. Mm. I think that I'm not. If you go to certain events, you'll see many different kinds of photographers. And I think that I'm probably someone who likes to hang around, and I take my time and I stand a bit more in the background. And I like to think that if you stay around for a while, people get used to you, and then you approach them when you feel it's the right time. And I think that that's something that's quite important to do. Not everybody have that kind of time, so they go direct, and you meet a lot of rude people too, photographing mm. sometimes.
Mm.
And I'd like to try not to be that rude person.
Mm-hmm.
If you have time, you'll have the results that you need anyway. And then if it's mutually good, then that's fine, you know. I try to talk to my students like that too, to make them understand that.
Mm.
And it varies. A friend of mine, he was at Lesbos Island with the refugees there. Mm. And they said it was crazy. There were so many people. They even would push refugees over to get that shot kind of thing. And it was disturbing to see how certain people worked. Mm. I could name names, but I won't do it here now. But and it would surprise you.
Oh, that's terrible yep. to hear that.
Yeah, that can be, yeah. So.
Maybe one last question, which mm-hmm. is sort of a central one, a challenging one, I think, for everybody, because I sort of asked this to everybody who comes through. What is ultimately the role of the artist? Mm. Considering you, if you want to, define yourself as such, what do you want your role to be? What do you see your role as being? What do you want to do? Why do you do it? Is another way of framing it.
Mm-hmm. Let me reflect for a second.
Yeah.
I mean, the answer is easy to some extent. Of course, you want people to hear the story or mm. see the story.
Mm.
That's what you want to do. And you're hoping that it will have an effect on people who make certain decisions sometimes. But then that kicks right back at how media is changing. So how do you reach that goal is a bit the question. You know, how do you use the, you know, in any field of work you have, in a way, you have a toolkit, you know. This mm-hmm. is what you do, and this is what you're trying to achieve. So how do you reach the people you're interested in? So in a way that some people would argue that the topic, life after genocide, is an editorial topic, but it's also a little bit of an academic topic. It's a humanitarian type topic. It's many different things. And I think that it's about educating. It's about finding out something that you wish that you knew more about before you started.
Mm.
And if you were interested in that, hopefully others are interested in that too. And in this topic, I think it's not that people are not interested in that. A lot of people are interested in this. It's just that people haven't seen all that much about it. Or you, if you do research, you come across. I mean, work exists. Quite a bit of work exists. But you realize that you meet people that went through, you know, genocide or other awfulness happens, and you realize it's happened a long time ago. But why do these people still suffer badly from having bad access to education, bad access to basic human rights or human needs, even bad access to all kinds of different things? That's surprising in 2018 in Europe, for example, in the case of Bosnia. And then you're creating stories because you're interested in showing that, look, this is still going on, and we never talk about it anymore. If you read newspapers around here now, it will be not many newspaper articles about what's going on in Bosnia today, apart from the other week when there were elections, but it will be a little small side note of some mm. sort, but that's it. Why does more than 50% of Bosniaks in the region of Srebrenica are still unemployed? That's a pretty high number.
Mm.
Actually, I've heard even higher. I don't know the exact number, but people talk to me about numbers up to 70%. Schools don't have heating during winter, for example, when you have a meter of snow outside. You have a divided school system. So you have different curriculum for Serb kids to Bosnian kids. I mean, Bosnian Serbs and Bosnian kids. So they have different history lessons that are telling two different stories. This, to me, does not sound like a good thing. So I think that that's something that would be useful to share this kind of information more, particularly when it comes from a country that would like to join the European Union, for example. So to have some kind of impact towards people who make decisions would be nice. Hmm.
Do you think you've had that impact
already a bit? Well, I think we've done things that has done a little bit in this direction. I've had projects shown here in Geneva, specifically at the International Human Rights Film Festival and Forum. Mm-hmm. That's a huge platform to share work where a lot of people are coming to visit. It's been published quite a few journals and magazines. It's been shown in London several times. It's been shown in the United States, in various places in Europe. And I relatively often go and talk at conferences and schools and educational establishments. So, I mean, we're doing things fairly constantly. Maybe, I don't know, I do at least 10 visits a year, sort of to schools and conferences, at least. So, I mean, the stories are coming out. There's no doubt about that. And there are invitations to do more of this. So that's the good news. I mentioned at the talk, too, one of the pictures from Srebrenica, or actually a few of them, were part of this exhibition going to be shown at the European Union, at European Parliament. Mm-hmm. 11 Lessons from Srebrenica, which I thought was brilliantly done by a Bosnian historian and genocide scholar. And the European Parliament decided it was too sensitive of a topic to be shown there. And that massively surprised me. It didn't surprise me that they drew this conclusion, but it surprised me still, because I think it would be a brilliant place to show this work. This was during July when the commemoration was going on.
What do you think they meant by too sensitive? They
were not general that, you know, it's important to be politically correct. It was this attitude that came in, and they felt it wasn't the right place to show this work that was showing the Bosniaks as the victims, basically. They failed to see the wider theme about this being about what causes genocide. That's basically what this exhibition was trying to show.
Mm-hmm.
And whether these guys were victims or these guys were the ones who committed genocide was perhaps a teen bit less important. It was, of course, included, but it was not the more important thing. The exhibition was still shown in various places, including in Sarajevo, which was nice to have it there.
Yeah.
At the National Library. But I think that it's important to give these lessons. Not as lessons, this is the only way, but as lessons, as reminders about what we need to try to avoid. And I think in Europe and in the world today, it's absolutely fundamental, because it's all about to happen again. You know, that's what it looks like.
Thank you for accepting to come on this podcast. It's been great.